Welcome to Series 5, Episode 7 of Conversation on Eagle Mountain, a podcast about the tribe. I'm your host, Lance, and joining the podcast panel today is Liz.
Hello.
Sabine.
Hi.
And Tamsin.
Hello.
With episode notes done by Matt and myself. So Series 5, Episode 7, the screenplay was done by both James Wiley and Harry Duffin. It was directed by Julian McSweeney. And the episode synopsis read out by Liz.
There are revelations and reunions in Liberty as Lex enters town. As the power returns in the city, Trudy tries to cheer up Jay, May has a surprising message for Stats and Wizard, and Java's scheming bears fruit.
So, I mean, the obvious elephant in the room, the dual writers on this episode, so I have to imagine that Harry Duffin was brought on to kind of script doctor this episode because Nick Miller had to be written out.
Yeah, probably.
And poor Harry, for all his talent and love of these characters in this world, can't polish a turd.
No.
Unfortunately, yeah. As we were just saying in the pre-chat, I found this episode really hard to get through.
Yeah.
There's a lot more dialogue, which is Harry's staple. There's a lot more informative dialogue, dialogue that is informed by the characters, dialogue that gives the characters some hidden motivation you can read into. I did notice that, and that is his talent for using words to matter and what it says about the characters saying them, but he can't fix what is shattered already.
No. And something that we all picked up on was that these episodes feel quite plodding, but a lot is actually happening in them.
Me and this guy, Jack. He helped me out of the city.
Where is he now?
I don't know. He's been gone all day. He's a bit of a weird geek, but I didn't think he'd run out on me.
What's he look like? I might have seen him around.
Medium height, kind of skinny. Red hair, kind of talks funny.
A bit of a weird geek?
Yeah.
Well, it must be him. It's our Jack. Gotta be.
So with Jack missing, Gail is once again taken by the Liberty thugs, only for Lex to arrive and come to her rescue with additional help of Slade. Recognizing her description of Jack, Lex realizes that Jack wouldn't have abandoned her willingly. They track him down to where he's being held prisoner. So yeah, how did you react to Lex's arrival, the fight scene to rescue Gail, and his reunion with Jack?
So we've entered Coinkadink Corner, haven't we? Where we've characters just meeting up in some random barn, Lex turning up at exact moment we needed him to, and it feels very staged. Lex loses yet another fight. Panel, has he ever won one yet? I'm still convinced that Gail is dubbed. I still think there's something going on. Maybe it's the way she delivers the line, but I feel like she's dubbed. So in these scenes, it just feels quite artificial. But I would say I did love when Slade and Gail were talking and Gail mentioned Jack. And you kind of see on Lex's face, he gets this bright smile at the thought that Jack is around. He's rescued Gail. And yeah, I just like that moment because something we've always enjoyed about the tribe is the connections between the characters. And Lex and Jack, they've had their moments, but you really did feel in this that they are a family, the Morats. And I like that. I just like that feeling.
Yeah, it's kind of adorable. It's like, I mean, obviously Lex wasn't going to win this because, you know, he comes in. Lex. My first thought was like, Lex fighting, huh? How quickly is he going to go down again in this one? And then to have Slade walk in. Yeah, that was obvious. But the whole, yeah, the hints dropped by Gail about Jack and just the joy on Lex's face.
Yeah.
And then suddenly her excitement about Jack when she learns he was speaking your truth. He is a mole rat.
Mm.
I thought it was funny, the coincidence of Lex showing up at this barn, wherever this friggin' barn is, just outside of Liberty, I don't know, I thought that was funny, but I was like, okay, I'll let that slide because he is coming to, he is searching for, you know, Ram and following the tracks and ends up here. Fine. Okay. But when Slade walked in too, sorry, that it was just too funny that they all ended up right here at this barn. The way that was staged was hilarious to me. What I also thought was funny is I was like, the hint at Slade's private life in Liberty, like the fact that as soon as these guys see Slade, they start acting like Slade runs Liberty. I was like, Slade, what have you been doing? You're new to Liberty too. You've only been here a few days, maybe a week tops at this point, and already you're running the show. People are claiming to be like capturing prisoners for your sake, right? Right. I just thought that was a very funny hint at what Slade does in his private time, that he showed up at Liberty, wasn't even sure he was gonna stay, and now he runs the town. And we never see what Slade does to run the town. It's just enough to let us know that Slade's got, he's always doing something. He's making deals with people on the side, and he's already gained the respect of all the thugs in Liberty who answer to him now. And that made me laugh. When they have Gel, this is when I realized, I think this was the problem with Gel. They thought Gel was comic relief, or maybe that's what Harry realized, that was the only thing she could bring to the table was be comic relief. Because some of the things she says in this episode are genuinely kind of funny. I didn't laugh, but I saw the attempt to make me laugh by the things she was saying. Now, I don't know if it's her delivery or if the lines are just really bad. I don't know which one it is. It could be her performance, but I did get the hint, oh, Gel is supposed to be comic relief. And maybe that's what Harry saw when he was like, okay, this character, that's the only thing she's really good for, that she's kind of funny. She's the airhead who lightens the mood because she's so unaware of what's going on around her. And I was like, okay, I think that's the point of Gel. She's supposed to be funny. She's not her fault, but she's not. And yeah, but I loved also, just like you guys, Lex's recognition of Jack and the way he lights up and brightens and the way he defends Jack's honor without a thought. Just like, he said, that's our Jack. The way he said that, like, that's our boy. That's my brother. He wouldn't do that. He would not have abandoned this girl just anywhere if he decided to help her. And I just thought that was genuinely sweet and a taste of why we love these characters and their relationships to each other. And, I was like, yes, that was really nice. And again, it seems like we haven't had that since Jack and Chloe came home back in season 3, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Even the way he gives him, he's one of the original, he's an OG mall rat. You know what I mean? Like, he says that, he gives that to Jack. He does not write off Jack's importance to their family, their group. He gives him his stars. Like, that's our Jack. He's an OG mall rat. That's our boy. He would never abandon some girl he decided to help. He's not a great fighter. He's not a warrior, but he's one of us. He's got a moral code. He's got a good heart. And, you know, I thought that was really sweet. He seemed more enthusiastic talking about Jack than when he's talking about his own glory in the city to Gel.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, I was happy that Lex's response to Gel's over-the-top fawning with, oh, it could be so romantic down here in the hay. He instantly responds like, yeah, beds would be nice and a cot for the little girl.
Yeah.
And
it's like, he's instantly saying, yeah, no. She's just a little girl. That's not a...
Which is the reaction he would have to someone who looks like she's 11. Yeah.
But that's a good thing, you know?
That's a good thing, absolutely. That is the appropriate reaction for Lex to have to Gel.
Yeah.
She's a little kid, it is, you know?
But with the way they've been writing him over the past seasons, you know, I'm glad they at least gave him this.
I also liked his line about Gel helping him in the fight. Because when you think about Alice and Chai-San and Siva. You know, he kind of expects his woman to be able to, like, step up in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the line that made me realize, oh, Gail's supposed to be funny. Mm. And she's like, I can't fight. I'm a girl. And I'm like, they think she's hilarious. Because that's meant to be a funny line.
Yeah.
You know, Lex's reaction to it, the deadpan delivery of it, the fact that this is not the time to be playing the girl card, Gail. Please assist in your own rescue. You know what I mean? Anything. I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, she's supposed to be funny. Okay. I get it. I get it. And yeah, I did love them. I just was happy. I'm happy to see Jack, you know, and yeah. Lex's pure joy at seeing him. And I even like the line when Gail said something. I can't remember what it is now, but it's like derogatory to, you know, Jack's help, his assistance, everything. And Lex is just like, you're going to run out of knight in shining armors, girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was genuinely funny, you know? And I was like, oh, okay, she's supposed to be comic relief. I see. That's why she doesn't work in this world. That's why she doesn't fit in this world. That's supposed to be the joke, I think.
Meanwhile, Jay continues to beat himself up about Amber, Ved, and Ebony. Trudy resolves to cheer him up with her apparently famous pepperoni pizza after making sure that Amber is okay with it.
Oh, it'll work out, Amber. I'm sure it will.
Yeah. What kind?
Pepperoni.
Great. My favorite.
Oh, I'll make you another one then. I've invited Jay over for dinner tonight.
At dinner, Jay quizzes her about Brady's father and her single status, toasting her and hoping that she'll find the right guy soon. So yeah, how do you react, panel, to Jay and Trudy's definitely not a date?
My question is, where are they milling the flour to make the pizza? And where is the pepperoni coming from? Is this a case of Clara Oswald actually being a Dalek, spoilers, and Trudy is having some still being like brainwashed by the Chosen, and she thinks she's making a pepperoni pizza.
Well, we know that the flour comes from people milling it outside the city.
Okay.
Pride admitted that. So we can believe the flour
that's
is
doable.
Being milled outside the city and brought in. Not sure who's currying pepperoni. I guess at this point, Trudy has given up being a vegetarian. Fair enough. I'm not judging her for that. but it did feel a little awkward when she was like, I'd be like different. She said, I'm going to make my famous meat lover's pizza or, you know, something like that, where you're like, okay, but pepperoni takes a lot of time and energy. And it's such a specific processed food that it's the first time it's ever been mentioned. They're not specific about foods like that in the show. So pepperoni felt out of place for her to be like, my
bacon would have been
pizza.
Like ham and pineapple would have been
sausage.
So much easier.
You're like, okay, but pepperoni, I'm like, that takes a lot of time to make homemade, sweetie. That it's actually kind of almost a waste of your, it's just weird. It was a weird specific item for her to mention, pizza. If she was just like, my famous pizza or something, or the pepperoni was very specific. It takes you out of the world because you're immediately hung up on pepperoni. Where are you making pepperoni? How are you trading for pepperoni, Trudy? You don't just have that in the pantry. You know what I mean? You're too busy focused on that one word rather than just, yeah, she could do this. She could get the ingredients to make this. And then again, if you're a lore hound, you're like, Trudy, when did you start eating meat? When did that change? You know, even the Chosen only served her fruit, like fruit and bread and stuff.
She ate fish last season.
So, yeah, you know, but there are some vegetarians who consider fish okay part of the diet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as frustrating and annoying as that is, it's like you're not a vegetarian, you're probably a pescatarian. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At the time, there were people who used vegetarian to describe that and still ate fish. And
yeah.
And that made sense, you know, because she was with the Gaians back then, who basically lived of it.
But yeah, the pepperoni just takes you out too much. You're too much. You're too locked into the word pepperoni.
Yeah.
You're like, wait, what? First of all, it doesn't help when she's like, my famous. Like, Trudy, I have known you for 5 years and you've never made a pizza. Never made a pizza.
Had Celine said that, I would have, you know, accepted it quicker. Because at least we know she knew how to make bread and stuff.
I mean, Trudy made a cake once in season one. But yeah, she's never been.
She cooked that rat.
And she cooked a rat. But she's not known for really just, you know, cooking. It's not. So it's just weird, again, to be like, my famous. And it's like, you're not famous for cooking, Trudy. That's not
you. Is that a Harry thing, though? Because if you remember, when she did cook that rat, they were talking about how great she was as a cook.
Yeah, and she was the best cook ever.
Yeah, so maybe it's a Harry thing. Maybe when he's done the script doctoring, he's added that in as a callback to when she was good at cooking, even though that's the only time it was mentioned.
Well, I was thinking about this. We just had episode 6 with the Bray send-off. Their famous spot apparently came from out of nowhere, even though we've known them for how many years and we've seen how much time they've had to actually go anywhere. So I think it's something like that. They just try to make a fake callback and it just doesn't kind of work. It's never been a thing.
Yeah, it's just a little awkward the way it's set up. And you're, like I said, you're too caught up on the specific wording of what she's going to make and you're like kind of lost in that. I have to say, the scene between Jay and Trudy.
Yes, the dinner.
It's nauseating.
Even before the dinner is, okay, I can excuse the scene just where she's trying to cheer him up before, when she butters him up with the pizza to cheer him up. I will say this. This is definitely Harry using dialogue to infer things about the people. And I don't think Harry has the best opinion of Jay as a character. Because if you listen to Jay, his dialogue infers just how selfish and self-centered a person he actually is.
Yeah.
And just begging for sympathy. And even in his own dialogue, and I do think this is only Harry would have done this, he admits straight up that he's not focused on his girlfriend because he's obsessed with another woman.
Yes.
Harry makes him take ownership of that. I don't think any of the other writers would have. I think Harry sees Jay for the garbage person he actually is. Mm-hmm. And the dialogue speaks to that. And then Trudy, that toxic positivity, I feel that her dialogue speaks to how much she's projecting onto Jay, her own guilt, the things that she carries, her obsession with him not blaming himself, letting him off the hook for the role he played. There's such a desperation to it. It feels more like this is what Trudy's trying to tell herself about the role she played. And if she can't let go of her own guilt, she's desperate to make sure another person doesn't end up in her same mindset. And what she says to him is so on brand with the sort of things that Amber has always said to Trudy. It's not your fault. You can't be to blame for that, on and on. But you realize that Trudy, as much as she wants to believe Amber, never really has believed Amber when she's been told she's not to blame for her role in The Chosen. And now she's vomiting this up and projecting onto Jay the same, you know, speech, same words, same affirmations. You're blameless. It's not your fault, on and on. And then finally gives up and is like, how about I do this to make you feel better? So I do think that's an informative moment. And so good use of dialogue. I don't know about you guys, but that dinner was one of the most awkward moments of my life.
It was very uncomfortable to watch. It was from both of them as well. I mean, I love Trudy, but I find her, it's too saccharine. It's too much. It's too sweet. It's too care. It makes your teeth hurt.
It's too desperate.
She's so desperate. Yeah, you're right. That's what it is to be. She's desperate. There's this edge of desperation in everything that she's trying to do. And like you say, Liz, it leans back into possibly her own guilt, the way she feels about herself. But it's come out of nowhere. That's the thing. It's like we've never seen them interact like this before. We've seen a couple of scenes through the last portion of this season, but season 4, they never interacted really. And this has all come out of nowhere, and it feels so fake.
And I kind of wonder, now, as you guys said, it feels desperate. It feels like, is Trudy into Jay all of a sudden, you know? Because before, you could just say that Trudy just likes him as a person and wants him to feel better about himself, because she's always been pushing him towards Amber. You know, she noticed the attraction between the two of them apparently right away and has been pushing them together as hard as she could. Even during their talk, she's like, I could talk to Amber for you. And it's like, why are you so desperate for these two to get along? Why does it matter so much to you that Trudy, like that Amber hooks up with Jay, you know? Why can't you just let that go and just let it progress naturally? Why do you feel the need from the moment you saw these two look at each other in season four to push them towards each other? That is odd. That's very
weird.
It's
projecting.
That she's, yeah, and that's what I'm wondering. Has there been some deeper attraction to Jay that Trudy herself carries, but never thinks that a guy will look at her because the show has never given her that? And so she's projecting that onto Amber. Like, you should have him. You know, he likes you. You should, because she's been pushing Amber toward Jay since they met in the Gaian camp. You know what I mean? Like, from the start, it's been Trudy being like, oh my gosh, I think he likes you. I think you like him. Da, da, da. And Amber's like, what the frick are you talking about? You know? And this felt so pushy. And like, why are you this obsessed with Amber and Jay hooking up? Do you feel something? Are you living through Amber? Is she your avatar with the things you can't have in life? You know what I mean? And during the dinner, it's like, is this desperation coming from your own attraction to him? And you know, you don't think you could possibly be his type, so it's awkward, it's very uncomfortable to watch.
It's interesting. I'm not sure it's just that though, because I was gonna say that I didn't feel that until the moment when he complimented her, and then she had the glass of wine and she lifted it up and she looked at him, and I think for the first time she felt an attraction to him. Up until that moment, I didn't see it necessarily from her side. But when he complimented her and she went all giggly, I saw it then. And I was like, no, you suddenly realize you fancy him.
And that's a real moment. And that's quite possible. That's what I'm saying. Like, is she projecting without even realizing that's what she's doing? And you know what I mean? Like, is that what this has been drawn to from her own attraction she wasn't even aware of? And we know Trudy doesn't think well of herself, and so if she's attracted to a guy, it's very easy to imagine that she can't imagine he'd be attracted to her at all in any way, you know. And then he compliments her and it's just like something lights up inside of her. And I do think it's important to acknowledge the point where she seeks permission from Amber as well. Like, because again, she's been pushing Jay and Amber toward each other, and then she's caught out making him dinner, and she's like, and I think Trudy believes this, I'm just trying to cheer him up, I'm just trying to be a friend, I feel really bad for him. And Amber's like, no, I think that, but she seems nervous of what, how Amber would see it. And Amber's like, no, I think that's great, you know. And then she just is straight up honest, I may have feelings for him, whatever I might feel, it can't happen because I'm not going to get past him being a techno and what the technos did to Bray. And Trudy's like, oh, because she seems shocked when Amber goes, I think that's a great idea. She's like, really? You know? And Amber's like, yeah, totally, go for it. And there's a relief in Trudy, like, okay, I'm not doing anything wrong, it's okay for me to enjoy this guy's company, to be a friend to him without stepping over any lines. I think that also matters, that she's seeking permission from, you know, her friend, who's the ideal choice in her eyes. This is with quote signs. This is what Trudy must see it as from her point of view. Amber is everything she can't be. Amber is the girl that all the guys fall in love with. And Trudy basically behaves like the ugly best friend. She's not. Please understand, I'm not saying Trudy is an unattractive person, but from her point of view, she must feel like the ugly best friend who's simply there to be a sidekick for her bestie's endeavors and love and all that. And for once, maybe Trudy's like, could I be the main character? Could it be me? Possibly.
I always wondered for a bit, though, is it just an attraction to Jay that made her you know, see him as a great guy that she wants to shove onto Amber? Or is it that she wants Jay to find happiness because if he can find someone after the things he's done, maybe she'll be allowed to as well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's probably a mix of all of that. I mean, if we've seen from Trudy, her desperation to forgive people their crimes, again, she's projecting what she wants for herself. It could be in numerous reasons why she wants Jay to be happy, why she wants Jay and Amber to be happy together. You know, she is seeking for her friends a life she doesn't believe she can have or deserves, possibly. And I'm just spitballing. But when you have low self-worth for yourself, but you actually do tend to be a decent human being, you want happiness for everyone, happiness that you don't believe you deserve.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing she may feel she has to give. Again, with such a low self-image, she doesn't think she deserves anything nice. So what role does she have in the world except to be decent to everybody else, to make other people happy, to be a force for good in their life? That might be the only thing Trudy thinks she has to offer.
Yeah.
And then for Amber to say, okay, this guy, you know, he's not good enough for me because I can't get over what he's done. It might have something to do with Trudy going, okay, well, I'm not good enough for anyone, so, you know, if he's not good enough in Amber's eyes, maybe he's suitable for me.
That's, yeah. It's so sad when you analyze it, but again, this episode actually does have, you know, dialogue that is informed by what the characters might think and feel, so there's something to actually debate and discuss about what they're saying and why they're saying it, you know, which is the only real thing I can appreciate in the episode. It's like, okay, this makes me think about a few things about the people. I remember the first time I saw the scene with Trudy and Jay, as awkward as it felt even then, I was still rooting for her, because it's like, as soon as Amber signed off on it, I was like, all right, so Amber's out of the running, you know, okay, fine. We already saw the kiss between she and Jay, so maybe that's all it was, him trying it off on her, and she's made her decision that no, I don't sense any hesitation from Amber. I don't sense any like, nah, you know, like I kind of like him, but I'm pretending I don't. No, it seems straight up. She's made her decision. Can't get past this. Never going to happen. So I was like, okay, so is this Trudy's slot now? This is how her and Jay are going to end up together. This mutual desperation to be seen as decent people from a world of that won't forgive you for your past sins, you know? And so as awkward as it was, I was still rooting for her. I was like, okay, she doesn't have much dating experience. I mean, it was awkward between her and Martin. It was awkward between she and Bray, you know? So she doesn't have a lot of experience. It's going to be a little weird between the two of them. And, but it got so uncomfortably awkward. Jay is trying to friend zone her so hard.
Yeah.
So hard he's trying to friend zone her.
But at the same time, he's trying to friend zone her, but at the same time, he's going out of his way with those compliments.
He doesn't want her to stop treating him like he's still a wonderful person. He doesn't want to like rub her off that way. Like, oh, please still thinking the sun, moon, and stars of me, but... You know, I still need you to stay. I don't want to give you any ideas. I don't want to lose your attention, but I don't want to give you any ideas. That was what his behavior played to me as. Like, please say, still say I'm wonderful and then I'm not to blame for anything. But, you know, you're just a really great friend.
I do think, though, you've got a really good point whereby in different hands Trudy and Jay might have been quite interesting, because they've both been involved in these. One was in a cult, what I wouldn't call the technos a cult, I'm not quite sure what to call, let's call it regimes. So they were both involved in regimes that did terrible things, and they were complicit in that, and now they are making amends, atoning. They've lost a lot. They are faced with what they have done, and there's so much you could do with them. if they were to be a couple. There's so much you could have done with them. And I mean, Ebony finding out that Jay is now with Trudy, brilliant, just beautiful. But yeah, it's just a placeholder until he gets with Amber, yeah. And it's disappointing, because what you really want is for the audience to fully invest, and then you kind of almost want like a ship war situation, don't you? Where you've got people who want Amber and Jay, I don't know who they are, but I guess there's one of them out there somewhere. And then there are people who want Jay and Trudy again, I don't know who those people are. And you kind of want to invest in these relationships. You don't want to feel like it's just a placeholder until the real thing comes along. And that's what this feels like. Wherever this goes, it's just a placeholder.
Another thing I thought was interesting is that Jay comes right out and asks about Brady's father. And the fact that she chose not to tell him the relationship to Bray was another way of her trying to protect him from the guilt she genuinely thinks he feels. Like, Trudy believes him. She believes he feels remorse, and she doesn't want to make it worse. So she completely ignores the fact that she lost Bray too. Brady lost Bray. So she just, you know, she doesn't even mention that Brady's father is this creep that everyone's seeing in the streets, and that he's Bray's brother. Like, she doesn't give him any information that she thinks would make him feel worse. Because she thinks he actually feels guilty for what he's done. And even though when he's talking, he makes it very clear he does not feel guilt for what has happened to Bray or his brother. He just hates the way it makes him feel, and that he's lost his chances with Amber.
And the way it makes him look.
Yeah, you know. But I thought that was so interesting. He straight up asks, okay, so Brady, her father, you know, and in a nice, polite way. And she's like, oh, it's just a mistake. Just, you know, regret. Nobody. Certainly not the ghost that everybody's seeing walking around the city. And he certainly wasn't related to Bray, who you're responsible for not being here anymore. Like, she's just, you know, she was so tactful. Yeah. About the information she gives him, just, oh, you know, there was somebody, but he didn't feel the same about me, you know, which was very graceful of her. But again, Trudy is hiding her own pain to make other people feel better.
Yep.
Because she loved Bray, both as a lover and a brother and a friend. Nobody loved Bray as hard as Trudy did. I'm sorry, I'll die on that hill. And even now, she is holding that in so that Jay doesn't have to feel bad about it.
Mm. And it's horrible.
Yeah.
That he feels that he needs to.
Like, she can't tell him, oh, you know, that people are seeing that ghost is you. Yeah, that's my baby daddy. So it's messing with my head too. You know, I do think later she will tell him. But right now she's still protecting everybody else, you know, and burying her own pain and her own hurts and vulnerabilities so that everybody else can be happy and have a happy life. And that's just a unique choice for her to make. And Jay's classic, I hope you find someone. I'm sure there's a guy out there for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a bit of a dissenting voice in that, because as the dinner went on, it kind of was turning more into more of a romantic liaison. And I think Trudy, just from my perspective, I think she kept that information more so because she didn't want to reveal her own connections with Sue rather than
possibly.
The Bray issue.
That's a good point.
Probably both. Yeah.
But she was obviously having romantic feelings for Jay at this point.
Yeah.
But see, that's what made the dialogue good, because there's a lot you can like dissect about it. What did it mean? What is it saying about the character? It makes you think.
It's saying so, Harry was there.
Like, is Trudy keeping this back because this isn't something she's ready to reveal about herself to someone she's feeling an attraction to, you know? Like, that's very valid. Possible. I mean, yes, later she confesses to him about the Chosen and Zoot and all that. But right now, maybe she doesn't want him to know that about her. I certainly would be sensitive if I were Trudy.
Back in Liberty, Slade digs for information on the situation over in this city and Lex's reasons for being here. He soon realizes that Lex is looking for Gabe, but hides his presence. Later, Slay confronts Ram about his true identity and says that it's now time to see what Ram can do for him rather than the other way around. So yeah, how did you react, panel, to the various deceptions going on here? And what did you think of Slade's motives?
I think it's hard to look back at this, to actually watch this episode without hindsight on what Slade's motives actually are. Because at this point, I still feel like it's very vague as to what's going on intentionally, because it feels like that end story was made up on the hoof, basically. But it feels like maybe he's looking to get the most out of any situation. He's managed to get hold of Ram. He wasn't sure who he was, etc., etc. But it's hard to read his motivation without knowing where this is going. Does anyone else feel like that?
Yeah, I think that's the point. Like I told you, when Slade first shows up, he's a perfect mashup of Bray and Lex, as a person. And I mean, remember, Bray was often very similar when we first meet him in season one. You're not really sure what's motivating him, why he's so wishy-washy, why he's hiding things, why he isn't where he said he was, why he's not actually coming back with supplies to help the group. Why is he lying about this? It's not until the reveal with his brother. And you're like, oh, okay, I get it now. And so Slade, it's a much longer time before his reveal comes out as to what's motivating him.
Mm-hmm.
I like that there's a really weird gray area that Slade lives in. He rescues Ram because he's somebody who needs to be rescued. And he admits, I don't want to live in a world like that, you know, where someone would just leave a man to die in a garbage tip. I don't want to be that person. So he's got some sort of a moral code and he's going out of his way to heal him, but he does consider abandoning him. You know, he doesn't know who this guy is that he's rescued. Does he rescue him because he's a techno and he knows at least that his brother ended up with technos? Is that part of it? You know, I like the fact that when he does figure out Ram's importance, he doesn't really care about Lex's issues anymore. You know, he's like, oh, okay, that's not important to me. What's important to me is getting to my brother. And I just found myself with the most important techno on my hands, you know, and immediately goes to blackmailing Ram. You know, like, I think I like that. It really thickens him as a person.
Yeah.
And it makes him very believable in this world, because I don't think you can survive in this world by being all good or all bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And I also like how natural he is at fishing for information. It doesn't make Lex look entirely stupid that he's giving it. We know that Lex at this point is desperate to find Ram because he's trying to find Tysan and all that jazz. And then we also know that Lex has been written as, doesn't take much for him to just reveal information. He's always been that way. So I don't feel like he looks any dumber than usual and doesn't suss out that Slade is fishing for information. And Slade does a good job of hiding that he knows who Lex is talking about. Like, oh, okay, you know, I hope we find him, you know. I'm not surprised the guy took over Liberty within a week. Let's just say that. I'm just not surprised. Yeah. He's got great people skills, okay?
And it was Gel who let it slip in the barn that Lex was the sheriff. And you could see that shot of Slade, and he realized that Lex is probably looking for somebody, and that somebody probably is Gabe. And you kind of saw it in that moment. So, yeah, I agree with you. It makes sense as to where he is, how he's getting on, why Liberty thinks he's great.
It's the accent, man.
He just knows how to get things organized. He could just say, look, come here, tell what's in your pockets, turn out your pockets. Right, go over there. Think about what you've done.
He's good at figuring out what it is you want so that he can work with you and like figure that out.
Yeah.
I did think it was funny the way the scene was staged, where like they've started a fire in that barn. Like that's the place where they're going to stay tonight. So I'm thinking, okay, is this too far from Liberty? So they have to stay the night in the barn. That's why they've started a fire and maybe cooked something over the fire. But then Slade's like, oh, I can get you some beds. I'm like, then why are you guys still in the barn with a fire? Again, is this part of Slade's, just his MO? Like he doesn't offer to get them a room for the night until he's gotten information he could use from Lex, You know, I found that interesting. He lets them think you guys are going to have to sleep in this barn tonight by even helping them start a fire, only to finally reveal, well, Liberty's literally right there. Like, I can get you guys a room. You could stay here, or you can stay in the rooms where he can control them. These three people, especially the sheriff who's looking for Gabe, you know, he needs to know where they are. And that's best if he gets them a room where he can keep an eye on them and keep control of the situation.
It's interesting, though, because that shows that Slade is absolutely confident he can get those rooms from Ruby. Not an issue. Just bat his eyelashes and it's done.
I know. I love it. It's like, what if she's rented them out? He's like, I got it.
he'll just go for the smolder and then, you know.
I rule this town now. Have you not gotten the message? In fact, I didn't see season 5 from the first few episodes. I like ended up in the middle of season 5. So like very early on, you see that Slade is written to as if Liberty's his town.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I thought. I thought he was from Liberty, and I didn't know how he'd found Ram or whatever, but I was just like, oh, so Liberty, it's Slade's town. He runs the place. So when I went back and saw the beginning of season 5, I was like, how did he take over the town? What did the town answer to him now?
Well, Ruby does what he wants, and, you know, everyone else,
everyone else.
Have Ruby on your side. Yes.
Because there's going to be a scene later where, I don't know who what it was that tries roughing Ruby up. Maybe it's Lex. I'm not sure. And she's like, Slade won't like hearing that you treated me this way. And I'm like, So it's like all of this information is telling you Slade runs this joint. Everything. And it doesn't match up with what we were introduced to. That he's just a guy who wandered into town. Ruby, this is your town. But no, she's already on board with Slade keeping people in line. It's so funny. Like, Slade is such a fascinating character. He's so fun. Again, the logic of it is ridiculous, but season 5 is not about logic. We have to accept that.
It's just vibes.
It's just vibes, mm-hmm. man.
And he's Slade, got impeccable vibes.
He does. It's like, of course, this Liberty just listens to Slade now.
Now, I want to ask you guys a question. So, obviously, Ram was making his list, right? Why did he cross Mega's name out of? What does that mean?
I know, it's like you haven't got him yet, Ram. You're really jumping the gun on your revenge. I hate that. It's a pointless moment. It's like these lists have been done better in the past. You know, when Ebony comes out of her, remember, she's captured, she's vulnerable, she's in a state, and then she comes out of it and she makes her list of people who are going down. That's an impactful moment because Ebony has at this moment decided to give up being vulnerable and open to people and going back into her vengeance because it's the only thing that works for her and it's the only way she gets what she wants. It means something when she makes that list on the mirror of the people who are going to pay for life. they're going to pay. When Ram does it, it's like, Ram, you didn't even do the list right. You've already crossed somebody off who's still at large. This doesn't make any sense. Just circle his name. It's like such a simple thing. Circle it so we know he's first on the list. He's your main objective. It's silly. I thought it was a pointless scene. They just needed to let you know what Ram was doing right now.
Yeah.
It's very, very silly. But yeah, I do like Slade confronting him. And finally, you can even see that he's a little giddy. Like, he wasn't sure how useful Ram would be to him as a techno, but now he knows, okay, I can use you, and this is how it's going to go. He lets him know, someone's hunting you, buddy. You're wanted. I know your name. So he just lays it out, and Ram's like, crap, he's got me over a barrel. Fine, we're going to have to work together, because he's got all the cards are in Slade's pocket.
It's nice to see him realize that, though.
I also love the fact that, again, this is just part of Slade's personality and makes him intriguing. He doesn't seem all that concerned about why Ram should be wanted. Like, why should people want him? And should they have a right to have him because he's done bad things? He does not care. He has his own objective. So it doesn't matter to him that Ram should be captured or deserves to be captured. That, like, whatever, you know, Lex is after him for, as a sheriff of the city, that it could be deserved. What he cares about is his own personal objective, getting to his brother, and he will use anybody he needs to get there. He's not going to slaughter people. Again, he has a code of how far he'll go, but using you, oh, he's on board. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. And that's one of the things I missed about early season Bray. Like, that ability to be like, I have my own thing I want to do. I'm not trying to save the world. I'm not going to outright hurt anybody, but I will use you to get what I need done.
I have to say, I did laugh a bit because I was like, wait, how does this get stretched out for 40 episodes? How does this work? I can't remember. How does this get stretched out so much?
Slade's really good at keeping secrets, man.
I was like, oh, okay. Oh, this happens quite early. It's like, oh, so that he must get the information early on. Like, well, how does this? I've forgotten. How is this not resolved?
Because Slade literally keeps the secret until they have decided, till the end of season 5. It's in act 3 when mm-hmm. they've come to take over the city. Up until then, we still don't know why Slade is on board with any of this, why he cares, why he saved Ebony, why he's leading Liberty into a rebellion to attack the city. It's not until that moment that they've got Mega that he's like, he's my brother, I won't let you kill him. And it's like, what? They really left you on the hook for a whole season as to what does Slade want? Maybe he's just a nice guy. And that works because he does have such a amiable personality. You're like, okay, mm-hmm. so he's just a rogue who's been given something to fight for. And then you finally get to the end. You're like, oh my gosh, he never gave a crap about any of you people. You were just the friends he made along the way. Yet somehow it works for him. It works. Slade's just well written, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I also think Matt pulls off really well as well.
Even if he had no idea where this was going, if according to Kaylin, these guys were literally getting the scripts the night before. Matt Robinson was really good at, even if he had no idea where Slade was going, he just was intuitive on how to play the character.
Yeah.
So that no matter what it turned out his story was, it was going to work. And I'm like, talent, because I had no idea until that interview with Kaylin, just that these kids really had no idea where their characters were going, where the story was going. That's crazy. How are you supposed to play the character if you have no idea where the character is going at all? You have no idea whatsoever. And so it's like, to be that intuitive, to be like, okay, I don't know where this character is going, so how should I play them so it still makes sense? I mean, even in the Harry Potter mm-hmm. franchise, JK made sure to tell Alan Rickman the secret about Snape. He was the one actor she was like, look, I think you're going to need to know this so that you can play it right. And that's the only reason why Alan Rickman in the Harry Potter movies works, because he knew the secret that would be revealed about Severus Snape all the way at the end. And but even she had to give him a hint, and yet Matt managed mm-hmm. to play this with no hints. So kudos. Kudos, Mr. Robinson.
All right, let's head over to the main event. This has been a long time coming, panel.
Yay! Let's celebrate.
So, May hangs around at the casino to track down Stats and Wizard, telling them about the Morats' decision not to hand over Ram. But May has a hidden agenda here, as she instead encourages them to kill Celine rather than let her go. A furious Pride overhears, and there is a struggle in which he is shot. As he lays dying, he asks May to promise to tell Celine that he loves her. So yeah, quite a lot to unpack here. What did you make of Pride's death?
So there's a version of this,
finally,
which if you actually cared about Pride and they hadn't run his character into the ground the way that they have, it would have been actually quite sad. But that doesn't exist because they ran his character into the ground. And I, for one, am happy to see the end of him. Good. I'm glad. He can never haunt us again. Now he's dead. We've all seen him dead. He can't come back. It's over.
Pretty much that.
War is over.
I agree that it could have been such a tragic thing. Because remember, like, Pride is literally the reason we can't find him is because he's trying to search for his fiance. Like, that's actually really beautiful when you think about it. He, you know, like, he's searching for her. He didn't even really search for Amber. Remember the one he loved so much and he stayed in the city for? He didn't even really try to find her, you know? And yet he's out there on the streets. We don't know where he is. He's sleeping on the ground because he's trying to find Celine. That should be so romantic and beautiful. Of course, they ruined him. And so we don't care, but, and only to be like, discover that someone he trusts or that they all trust, he's supposed to be one of them, is actually trying to get Celine killed. You know, yeah. I like, that's wild.
And then to ask that person to tell the ones he was trying to get killed that he loves her.
Yes.
Honestly, that was just May's instant karma. Like, karma backhanded May and ran over her with a tractor in this moment because yeah. Like she's pulling an Ebony. Okay. This is such a season one and two Ebony move where it's like, yeah. if the guy I want wants another woman, my logic is I just need to remove her by any means necessary. Yeah. She doesn't care if she gets the guy by default. She doesn't care if she's not his first choice. She just wants to be his only choice. Okay. So that's what May's thinking. But I do like this difference. Ebony would have been much more methodical in getting rid of Celine. More May, it's mm-hmm. like just an idea, a desperate idea that popped in her head, and she just acts on it without considering the consequences, because that is very May in many ways. When it comes to her yep. personal self-preservation, she does not consider the consequences. And so here she goes. She tracks these guys down, finds them, convinces them to realize that the Mallrats will allow Celine to die, you know, and their only salvation is if they kill Celine. Only for the man she's doing all this for to swoop in, die because of her actions, and his last mm-hmm. words to her are to tell Celine he loves yeah. her. Like, that is the best karma you could ask for. Or May, mm-hmm. like, you just lost everything. This man gave you no words of comfort. His last yeah. breath was to let you know he will choose you.
Yeah.
Like, if you hate May, this should have made you so happy. That's all I have to say. If you hate her, this is like the best payback she could have gotten.
Yeah. Yeah. But karma gets everybody in this thing. Because we get the May karma, as you said. We also get the pride karma for being an awful person. You know, taken down by a zapper at last. Finally, we had to sit through him. He made season four worse than it needed to be. He increased the misery every time he was on screen shouting in people's faces, being irrational, even before he got mm-hmm. the addiction, right? You couldn't tell me when he was addicted and when he wasn't. The behavior was the same. It was the same behavior, right? And yep. I'm just glad mm-hmm. that he is gone, that we are free.
He even gets like a derpy death face.
Yes!
Like, he doesn't even die with dignity. He's just sprawled out in an alley, staring off into space with this weird expression on his face.
Wonderful. A perfect end for a character that should have departed in season three and been recurring, probably taking the space of Hawk. Right? That's what Pride mm-hmm. should have been. Instead, he stayed way too long. We hated him by the end. And I, you know, couldn't be happier. Made my Sunday.
I don't think I'm trying to think if has there ever been a tribe death that made me laugh?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Because like Ned's, right? Ned's was brutal.
Yeah, that didn't make me laugh. That was awful.
It was really bad. But this is like a comedy pratfall deck, you know?
And Ned was doing terrible things. And I still felt bad the way he went out. I was like, oh, man, this is tragic. This is tragic. But with Pride,
at least there we felt bad for Alice.
Like, nobody but Alice cared. Nobody but Alice cared.
But for Ned, we at least felt bad for Alice.
Yeah, I did. I felt terrible for her, and I felt something when he was murdered.
Yes, because it was such a brutal way to go.
And with this, we just feel, oh.
Right, especially since it was like he was motivated by trying to make this perfect life, take the fast track to having a perfect life with Alice.
Yeah.
you know? And something about that did touch me. I'm like, he's horrible and she deserves better. But I was at least invested in his motivations, you know, and didn't feel that's how he should have gone out, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I was like, damn, like, you were so stupid to get in with Ebony, and he was clearly in over his head. And I felt something for him. I felt some level of empathy for him as a person, as a human being. Yeah. And, but I, Pride's death, I felt nothing.
I felt like Celine dodged a bullet.
Yeah, well, I think Celine and May were both released from this, you know, because he's awful. He's an awful partner. And you can see why Amber didn't want a bar of him.
And she's not even concerned about him now. Like, she does not care that he's nowhere to be seen. Yeah. No offense. Amber's got other things on her plate, but it does make me laugh. So she doesn't give a crap that no one knows where Pride has been. She's like, he's looking for his girlfriend, I guess. Whatevs, not my problem. But yeah, it's comical. And I don't feel anything for Pride. I don't feel bad that Celine will eventually learn her man died. I don't feel bad for May. I don't feel anything. I giggled. I was like, oh my gosh. He's look at his face. Look at his stupid face. And his last words to May, even though she's absolutely devastated that he just got shot. And she's just like, what? Anything? Just tell me what you have to say. And his last words to her were a backhand across the alley. And I'm laughing. I don't even feel sorry for her. Like, and you guys know that I was Team May and the way he was treating her.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I was. Mm-hmm. But even here, I was like.
Well, I don't think you can be Team May in this moment because she's taken it too far, hasn't she? We've seen her do a lot of heinous stuff, but a lot of that was accidental, right? But there's actual intention here. She intended for them to kill Celine, to get her out of the way. And so you can't feel any sympathy for her in this moment.
I want to come out on a limb here because I don't feel like this was May. I'm sorry. I do not feel that this was May. I do not feel that she would do this.
Yeah.
Even to get a guy. I just don't.
I think.
I'm sorry for her previous actions. I just doesn't tally up.
Yeah, I actually agree with you there, Lance. Because we have seen her do a lot of stuff, but it was always incidental stuff. When you think about what happened with Dalt, there was no intention for that to happen.
There wasn't, yeah.
There was exactly. Behind this, real intention. Real hatred. And
as horrible as May has been, she's never actually gone out of her way to get someone else hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not intentionally.
I don't think it was specifically about Celine getting hurt. I think it was more about May being afraid of what would happen if Celine got free and they found out that she knew where she was all the time or who had her.
She didn't, though. Remember, she was blindfolded. She didn't know where she was.
She tells these people to basically go and kill her. So.
I mean, that's quite...
And that felt very far. I mean, I'll accept it. Fine. That's where she is. But I agree. It does not feel like something May would have done.
No.
And we've seen May quite desperate to protect herself, to protect her own well-being. But it's like, okay, so you're adding this as a facet of her personality, that driven far enough, she is okay with having someone killed so she can get the guy as runner up with no like proof that he would choose her after Celine's death.
Well, we know he wouldn't. He doesn't want her. That's the thing. It's interesting you mentioned Ebony.
He's not got into her.
Because Ebony is always...
Well,
she's always going to be... If she's not your first choice, she will be your second, and she knows that, right? She's got that assurity, right? That she is who she is, and you will want her, even if you don't want to admit you do. But May doesn't have that.
But see, the thing is, that's what they're trying to tell you here. They're trying to tell you that May is reasoning that what she's come to is that when Celine's gone, Pride's going to be sad, obviously. But she has accepted that Pride is the type of person who will still choose her, who will still sleep with her because he's lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And she's accepted that's good enough. That's what May has decided when they decided to write this, that they have said this is the kind of person that May is, that she is willing to be his backup choice because he's got nothing else.
Interesting. Because it's such a leap, because everything that he's shown of us, like, I think that was the case at the end of season 3. But since then, I think he just finds somebody else on. May, he just doesn't want you.
She's just hoping it. If she hoves into his field of vision after the loss, who else is going to want it?
Again.
Like, there's nobody else. I think she looks at it as like, well, there's no other competition in the mall. He won't end up with anybody else. I'll be there giving him attention. Yeah. And, you know, I know him. He'll still sleep with me.
Yeah.
Even if he wants it, desires somebody else, he'll be with me at least. I'll be available to him. That's what they're telling us with these actions.
Yeah.
That's how low May has fallen, that's what she's willing to take.
It's so depressing, actually.
Yeah.
This is a really, and this aside from, like, Pride's death is not depressing, but when you get into the motivations of Trudy and May, it is really depressing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, it actually is. And, you know, in a better story, it would be great. Because it's not unrealistic when you think about this world. All of these kids should be suffering from depression, to be honest. Every single one of them. The fact that, like, again, I do think that Trudy's toxic positivity is just a way of coping with this world and everything that's happened to her, you know? I do think there's something real about these characters feeling so lowly about themselves. And that's how they walk through the world. All of that's very realistic. It's not a great story, though, you know? And yeah, it is depressing to think that that's where May reasoned herself into, that's how badly she wants him. And she's not wrong that Pride, I believe, 100% would have ended up in her bed if he'd lived and Celine had died. I don't doubt it. It's part of his character. He would have totally still slept with May because he was depressed and lonely.
Am I giving him the benefit of the doubt? Is that what's happened here?
No, oh my God. I don't know. I just don't think there would have been anybody. I agree with you that if there was anybody else, he still wouldn't have chosen May. But there isn't anyone else that would have given him the time or day. So think about it. If May's plan worked, Assassin Wizard listened to her. Pride didn't overhear it. He wasn't there to stop it. So they would have freaked out. They would have killed Celine before she had the chance to enact her escape plan. All right. They would have zapped her. Okay. So she's dead.
Mm-hmm.
The kids, I don't know how they would have found out, but she would have been found. Pride would have been super depressed, fallen apart because he was going to marry her, guys. Never forget that. Anyway, and nobody would have been there. Amber wouldn't have been there. Trudy's not interested. So who else is there? We know that Siva's about to leave the mall. There's nobody else there. May would have been there every day giving him attention. Mm-hmm. He would have ended up back in her bed, even if he didn't love her. 100%.
That's true. Yeah.
And that's how she's looking at it. There's nobody else. If there's nobody else, he'll end up with me, even if it's just out of desperation.
God, that is so dark.
That is.
It is really dark, you know?
And it's hard. I agree with Lance. It's hard to picture the May we know willingly calling for her friend's death. Just so she can have this guy. I can see it being accidental. You know what I mean? I can see it being like May has different intentions. Maybe she just wants Celine out of the way, but not dead, just out of the way, you know, and then that accidentally gets Celine dead, you know, killed. That is more in May's wheelhouse, but I'm not saying it's implausible that May could come to this place. That this is just a new aspect of her, but it isn't one we've seen before. I'll say that. It isn't an aspect of her personality we've seen before, that she'd go this far. But maybe all that torture by the technos and the reality space addiction, and maybe that's where she is now.
Yeah, and I mean, it can't be easy to have been replaced in your own life. To have to sit in that mall and watch Celine and Pride. And even though we know how Pride felt about May, right, from his side of things, he was giving it all this. He was telling her he loved her, right? So from her side of things, she believed him, right? She believed that he loved her. And then she comes back after this traumatic event. And what's the first thing she's seeing? Pride shacked up with the equivalent of her best friend. Because in that mall, it's always been Celine and May, right? And it must have been really hard to see someone basically living mm-hmm. your life.
Definitely.
Mm.
I didn't think we'd come out of this feeling a little bit of empathy for May. That's so funny. Like, Celine's life is threatened. Pride ended up dead. May got all her karma at once. And yet, somehow, she's the one we feel bad for.
Well, I know that Maggie feels a certain way about May.
Maggie is going to kill us if she hears this.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that May's a really interesting, complicated character. And you do feel certain ways about her, you know?
That is crazy. This is a crazy moment. Crazy moment. If you hate May, though, if you hate her, then this is the best karma she could have gotten. No doubt. Hands down.
Mm-hmm.
Best karma she could have gotten, because like I said, his last breath, he made sure she knew it's not you,
it's her.
I won't choose you. I've never actually chosen
and it
you.
It wasn't Amber.
Like, girl.
I mean, that is a plot twist that I wasn't expecting, to be fair, given everything we've seen about Celine and Pride's relationship, right? I still thought it'd be Amber.
See, that makes it even worse for May, because think about it. She's being told twice there will always be another woman this guy prefers yeah. over her.
Mm-hmm.
There will always be another woman he prefers over you, May.
Even Celine.
You did all this for nothing and lost him anyway.
Well, what you're going to have to do, May, is you're going to have to get with that other woman. That is what you're going to have to do.
Yep. You're going to have to steal the other woman. That's the only way you're going to keep him from being with her. But am I sad Pride's gone? No. It was funny. Yeah. And again, not even dignified. Like, I should be. It should be dignified. He dies trying to save the woman he loves. But I never believed in he and Celine's love anyway. So,
yeah.
I didn't even know Zoot. And yet him dying trying to protect his brother from getting beat up at most was dignified and tragic and sad. He didn't go into the fight thinking he was going to die. He just believed his own legend that he was the best street fighter and he could take it, you know, mm-hmm. and no one's going to beat up his brother but him. That was Zoot's thinking. And then he died. And it's like, oh, that's so tragic. Just before he has even made a decision if he wants to be a father to the child he just discovered exists, you know. There's nothing, I don't feel any of that for Pride here. I don't.
No, and I think it's, if you look at the first shot of Pride, which is mysterious and interesting, like, who is this character? And then you look at that last shot of him dead, right? Eyes rolled back, crazy expression. Mm. That is the trajectory of his character.
Stupid blue puffy coat.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you come to the city.
Which definitely
smells. You know that coat smells. I can smell it through the screen.
That's what happens when you leave the woods.
I don't.
Yes, Sabine. Stay where you should be. Just stay there.
I don't know if Pride ever knew where he wanted to be. I think so much about Pride is defined by finding someone who needs him, someone who makes him feel important, and that's where he'll be. Because remember, before Amber ended up with the Guyans, he was leaving the Guyans. So, I mean, I'm not even sure that's where he naturally belongs. He's someone who needs to be tethered to another person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Pride died before discovering where it was he needed to be. Because I still don't buy his proposal to Celine. You know, I really don't. They didn't sell that relationship for me to feel anything for the reveal we're going to get. That he proposed, wanted to settle down with her. I think just Pride doesn't know who he is, where he's meant to be in his life. He just tethers himself to other people.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And that's a shame. That's the only sad thing about his death. He's young and his frontal lobe hasn't grown in. He doesn't know who he is. And, you know, maybe like, I've written him 8 years in the future, he would have been a decent person, you know. He would have grown into himself. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't die in that place at all, and it's not it doesn't feel tragic. It should, but it doesn't, and I'm not sad to see him go. It was long overdue, because he was gone a long time ago. The pride we fell in love with was gone a long time ago, and we never got any hints of the pride we loved watching that.
Yeah.
There was nothing for us to hold on to.
I agree.
Like, he was just a corpse walking around, and he's finally been put down, and it's like, about time. Only sad thing about his death is that Celine's going to take it so hard. And it's like, girl, you deserved better. You didn't need to take this as hard as you are. But she's going to... But we need a reason for her to step out of leadership, so... Bye, Felicia!
All right, cool. That brings us to our final thoughts of the episode. Java continues to worm her way back into Ebony and Seaver's lives, telling Ebony that Zoot wants them to work together, and that it's a shame she can't do much as a prisoner. Later, Ebony takes out the poor eco guard at Java's door and leads her outside, where they reunite triumphantly with Seaver. So yeah, panel, what did you think of the sisters coming together again? And yeah, the weird decision for this to be the closing scene rather than Pride's death.
I feel like that was intentional, actually.
Sorry, this is rude. How dare you make this triumphant moment between the sisters the pivotal moment of the episode and not Pride dying?
Yeah, I think that's how they actually feel about this moment, right? They do not want us to sit with Pride's death, because they actually don't care about it either, right? They are ready to move on. We're all ready to move on, right? So let's just do it. Nobody wants to end. Can you imagine if the episode had ended with a shot of Nick's face like that? Oh, my God. No one's coming back. That's it. That's the end of the show.
That's the cliffhanger ending, though. That's how you end an episode. Not the sister whooping for joy.
I agree with you. But I also think it's very fitting.
It's disrespectful. It is honestly, I feel like it's disrespectful. It's so bad to the character, to the actor. No, this is bad.
You get the feeling, though, that they checked out. I don't know whether it's because Nick let him down by deciding he wanted to go. Maybe there's some salty stuff going on here. But it does feel intentional. It feels like a decision was taken, because, like you say, where you should end this is with Pride dead, right? Because that is the beat on this, right? Yeah. But they go with the sisters because actually they're not interested in Pride. They're not interested in this. Nope. They really don't care. And they're more interested in Ebony. They're more interested in the sisters. They're more interested in what this will do to May and Celine. Pride, no one cares. They don't care. It is disrespectful, but it feels very intentional. Yeah.
It feels fitting. It shows they care as little about Pride as we've come to do.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah. And I mean, he's been gone for such a long time as well. I mean, he's been gone. How many episodes has he not appeared in? And you know something's going to happen because he pops up in this one. So you know, like, oh, okay, so he's back. And it's either going to be he's going to rescue Celine or something's going to happen. But it just feels.
It feels like the two scenes should have been switched, like flopped, where you get the scene of. Right. Like, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. The scene with Ebony and her sister should have happened. That should have been the next to last scene. And then the episode ends with Pride's death. Like, that just feels that's the way you end the episode.
Yeah.
This character's death. Not that should not be the next to last scene.
Yeah.
Because think about it, your last scene is meant to be like when you're telling a story or you're doing an episode, the last scene is meant to be the hook that makes you interested in the next episode. And I think it's telling that these guys believe that the hook isn't the fact that Pride just got murdered.
It's because intentional. Of
May's action.
Yeah.
They think the hook is that Ebony and her sisters are now going to run wild. Like, that's what you're supposed to care about. That's what's supposed to make you come back. That says a lot.
Yeah.
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 Because, I mean, this is just a matter of editing. You know what I mean? Like, this is all just about arranging your scenes for your episode. There's nothing stopping them from putting the Pride death as the last scene. And they were like, no one's going to come back after that. Like,
yeah. Yeah. That's what I think. I just think no one would come back after that. Because it's like, it's not interesting. Nobody cares about Pride. That's not a cliffhanger.
That is so fascinating right there. Because when he died, even I was surprised there was still a scene to go. I'm like, isn't this where it should end?
And ordinarily, it would have. Like, but not today.
Like, when I was watching the episode, I figured, I was like surprised that I didn't get to roll credits after his last words.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there's more. Okay. We're just, okay. I just don't recall that being the case in so many situations. Like, again, I have to harken back to Zoot's death. When he falls and hits the ground, the scene that comes right after is still focused on the fact that he's on the ground dead. It's Bray running downstairs, checking his brother, realizing he's dead. Like, everything that comes after his fall is focused around his death. They don't skip to something else happening. You know, and Dal, same thing, when he falls, the focus is around his death. Ned, the focus is around his death. They don't skip to a whole different subject. So it is weird that they chose to organize these scenes so that Pride dies and then we focus on something entirely different as the last scene instead. That's weird choice.
As we're talking about the sisters, it felt very rushed. I think this is the last time we're going to see that eco guard as well. Just putting that out there.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
We can retire Eco Watch now.
You can go home.
Yeah, they're done.
It's interesting that he was taking his orders from Mega and not from Amber or Jay.
Maybe he was taking his orders from Pride.
Honestly, yeah. I was so concerned about Eco Guy. That when Ebony takes him out, I was like, you're free, dude. You're free. Like, I was happy for him. He took his post so seriously. I want to know Eco Guy's story. You know what I mean? I really want to. And I'm just glad he's free from being locked in this room, watching this door, and nobody giving a crap about him. Like, you can go home, dude. I kind of want to know what's going on with Eco Guy, but I'm happy he's free now.
Night. I just want to say as well, can we talk about the logic of you're sneaking out, you've made this escape, right? And you're outside, you're in the courtyard of the place you've escaped to, and then you decide to do a really loud celebratory whoop, right? Where's the logic there?
You know. It's a sense of like, where nothing can stop us.
Okay.
Like that's, I think it's a visualization of what freedom can feel like to people. It's not logical to do this right where they are, but it's almost a declaration of we're powerful now. Nobody can stop us. We're not even afraid of being caught right where we are. I'm not saying it's smart or anything, but I think it's a visualization of that feeling of liberation that you aren't concerned that anyone could stop you. They can't stop you. And so they illogically celebrate where they could still get caught very easily.
I want to add another thing as well. So Siva kind of gets won over, in my opinion, a bit too quickly. I would have liked some scenes in the mall where Siva was not really being treated like she was being ignored, but like all of her scenes have either been like collaborative scenes. And she does say, well, they did treat me quite well. And then Java was like, yeah, but when they come back, you'll be out. They'll just kick you right out. And you kind of, I don't know. I felt like we needed something that would play into that way she felt about that and that she kind of had that paranoia and what is she going to do?
See, this is where I feel like Harry's writing can really be seen and why he can't polish a turd. Okay, because this writing between the sisters, as I said, Harry, when he writes, and he wasn't the only writer on the show who was capable of this, but we hail our Harry. What he does and what a good writer does, as I said, write with intention and the writing being informed by the characters and forces you to think about what motivates the characters. When you listen just to the dialogue between these sisters, I think he is tapping into the dynamic between siblings, especially the power an older sibling has over mm-hmm. their younger ones. If you forget everything else that existed, you can totally believe why Java is able to tap into her sister's insecurities and win them over. Because of the dynamic they've had, Java was born into a family, as older siblings are, with only adults. They are born into a completely different environment. There's like a saying that each child is raised by different parents. Younger siblings are not brought into a family where there's just adults. They are brought into a family with an older sibling already there, and the older sibling translates the world for them. And I know, as an older sibling, I have an unspeakable power over my brothers. If I ever wanted to tap into it, they will always look at me a certain way. Even when we don't get along, even when we fought, even when we have tension, I still have a power over my younger brothers. I was here first. I was their first. I'm one of the first people they've ever met and known in their entire lives. Mm-hmm. I do feel like Harry's doing a good job tapping into that dynamic. He's telling a story, unfortunately, that the show never told about the dynamic between the sisters, and Java tapping into that manipulative power that an older sibling can have over their younger siblings. And unfortunately, again, he can't polish a turd. Season 4 exists. They did not tell the story of the sisters in a believable way. They didn't explore the sisters, but I can see what he's attempting to do, because I actually hear it. I can see it in the dialogue of why Java is able to convince her two little sisters to free her and get away. I can see the story he's telling about them and the life they've lived. He can't fix what we already know, though, in that it hasn't been built up to Ebony freeing Java. You know what I mean? Like, when I'm listening to the dialogue mm-hmm. that Harry wrote for these two, I do believe that Ebony has always absolutely desired her older sister's acceptance and love. Okay? Mm-hmm. As a younger sibling, that's what she wanted. He can't fix the fact that that's not the story that was told. The story that was told, there's no reason for Ebony to let Java go free. Java has tried to kill you. Okay. And what we know, you never tried to kill her. All you did was get her kicked out of the Locos, and she wants you dead and has tried to kill you and been against you this whole time, except for once she tried to help you with Ram. That's the only thing we've gotten. So story wise, there's no reason for Ebony to fall for this, except she's out of her mind and desperate for someone to believe her and desperate for someone to see Zoot. And that's the only card Java has to play. Harry's working with that. He's doing his best to be like, maybe there's more to this dynamic than the show has given us. Maybe, you know, Ebony has always wanted a great relationship with her sisters. And here's her big sister finally giving her some acceptance, some validation, telling her, you're not crazy. I see what you see, and we should do something about it, but I need help. And in her desperate state of mind for that understanding, Ebony acts on it. You know, we know that we have seen Java manipulate Siva. She's less believable. I mean, like, more believable that she's on board. But you guys are right. Unfortunately, Harry can't fix what's been written and shown to us. He's doing his best. He really is trying to tell a story here. But we have a whole season before that doesn't fully support it. Mm-hmm. So it does feel pretty sudden that she got both these girls to just jump on board and run away with her. So, yeah, it's like a tale of two stories. You know, I would have preferred to see Harry's. I would have loved to see him write the sisters through season 4. I think he would have done an amazing job. A lot of writers would have done an amazing job with the sisters.
Yeah. Yeah. I especially think with Java as well, because as we've said, she's so untapped. She had so much potential to be so interesting.
But yeah, on the surface, I get it. I get why this was chosen, why this happened. And I can understand it. As a writer, I can understand how Ebony is like, yeah, okay, you understand me. You see him. I'm not crazy. And I've absolutely always wanted this from you. I've always wanted us to be a team. Because the way Ebony talks about Java is that Java was antagonistic towards her from the day she was born, you know, and she never felt that from her. but that's what she's always wanted. And then, you know, Java, again, using that to her benefit. Mm. And I wish, like, when you think about what happens after, again, with Java being an untapped character, just being script padding, I wish that they had actually explored Java wanting it too.
Yeah.
We know that Ebony and Siva have wanted togetherness. They've wanted a amiable relationship with their siblings. They've wanted that togetherness. It's not a surprise later on when Ebony confesses to Siva that that's what she's always wanted, because we've seen signs of it that that's what she's wanted.
Yeah.
But it's like, why didn't you ever show that from Java's point of view? That she also desired that. There's so much you could have gone into the upbringing that forced these girls to pick at each other. Someone wrote a fan fiction that for me became headcanon to explain the sisters. And in that head, that story, that pre-tribe, they wrote, because they obviously wanted to make sense of the sisters. Mm-hmm. They wrote that Java and Siva actually have a different father than Ebony, and that their mother basically left her first love, the, you know, Java and Siva's father, for Ebony's father, who had, like, was more established, mm-hmm. had more money, all that stuff. But he wasn't a good partner for her. And Ebony was always a symbol of she made the wrong choice, right? Mm-hmm. To have, you know, to leave, you know, the man, like, the poor man and marry this rich man. And basically what happened is the girls grew up, the parents fighting constantly at each other's throat, picked a girl to be their champion. And you see that in toxic families all the time. Dad's favorite child is this one. Mom's favorite child is that one. The kids get pitted against each other. Siva is the one who didn't get picked. She's somewhere in the middle between her sisters. So, you know, mom picks Java, dad picks Ebony. And these kids are basically raised like little fighting pit bulls their whole lives.
Yep.
And Siva's the only one who is like, I wasn't picked. I'm not even in the fight. I'm just somewhere in the middle. And in this pre-tribe, Ebony's last words with her mother was her mother telling her she regretted her, you know? And somebody cared enough to try to explain the dynamic of these sisters. And it's like, for me, I was like, that's the perfect headcanon of what happened to these girls. I wish the show had explored it more, explored that Java, Siva, and Ebony are both, they're all three victims of just a messed up childhood. And I just wish that Java actually wanted the sister thing to work out. And for whatever reason, it doesn't. And then she turns against Ebony and Siva again. But she never shows wanting to work with her sisters. She's never a human. She's never a real character. And I can see this working. That's all I'm saying. I can see this working. I can see the effort, but I don't think it's going to work in the long run. The way it's written, it's not going to work. Java's not written as a person. She doesn't have any real motivations. Like the whole conversation she has with, I think Ebony, or was it Siva? I can't remember, about like men can't be trusted. If you'd given Java the motivation that she's pissed off that Ram never chose her, that he always chose one of her sisters over her, you could write this off as just a jilted ex-lover trying to get revenge on the man she loved who hurt her. You know, anything. Give her something that makes her human rather than just, I don't even know what Java's motivations are most of the time. Like, is she just tired that, is she want to get free because she's tired of Mega, like, not freeing her? They're supposed to be working together, but he's keeping her locked in a room. And she's
well,
like,
is this
that's
the
it.
next part of the plan?
Right. Is this her and Mega working together?
Yeah.
Like, you work on your sisters so that Probably. They free you, quote unquote, not me. And then you know what I mean? Like, let us know what is Java doing? What is motivating her outside of, I hate Ebony. I got roller skates, she got a bike. You know what I mean? Like, come on, Java!
Alright, cool. That brings Series 5, Episode 7 to a close. Thank you very much to the panel, and we'll see you next time for Episode 8. So, until then, bye.
Bye.
Bye!
Bye!